Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right. Thank you for tuning in to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. And you are correct. I am not Kim or Amanda. My name is Erin Fairbanks. I'm going to be jumping in as your co-host. Well, I guess not even co-host. It's just me. They gave me the whole reins. David, you think I'm ready for it?
I guess we'll see.
So Kim and Amanda are out on the West Coast, finishing up the very first food book fair out in LA. So stay tuned next week. I'm sure they're going to be back to talk a little bit more and share some highlights. But today we are joined in the studio by myself and my guest, Taylor Chapman. Taylor is the Senior Vice President of the Nation Swell Council, and we're going to learn a lot more about that and him. But let's start, like him and Amanda always do, with a little bit of shop talk at, you know, what's the top of our kind of to-do list this week that we're feeling excited about. Taylor, I'm wondering, you said you just finished a book that you were pretty excited about.
Yes. So I finished over the weekend. It's called The Lonely City by Olivia Lang, and it was just excellent. She's an art critic and thinker in general, and it was inspired by the first time that she moved to New York City, and her life kind of fell apart, big breakup, and she found solace in a number of artists who had themselves explored themes of loneliness in the giant, densely crowded city. So Edward Hopper, Andy Warhol, and some folks that I didn't really know about before. David Winarowitz was one. Really fascinating look at especially the downtown art scene in the 1980s.
So did she overcome her loneliness, or did she make peace with her loneliness?
More the latter. Yeah. It wasn't like she found a new person and solved it that way, but I think she came to understand and explore it through these artists and their work, and she felt that in the end it was an extremely valuable experience, that it taught her a lot about what it means to be human.
Yeah, I've been thinking, it's funny actually that you bring up kind of loneliness. I want to give a shout out to another podcast that I really love called The Lonely Hour, hosted by Julia Bainbridge. And Julia, her entire podcast is exploring this idea of loneliness in all kinds of forms. And I think it's like such a creative take on this really common feeling that like can often be a little bit awkward to talk about. But one of my favorite things about her work is her Instagram handle, which is Lonely Hour Podcast. She is always posting lyrics from like lonely songs or quotes from kind of famous people, artists, writers, and the like, talking about their loneliness. And it's like the kind of highbrow version of the Us Weekly. They're just like us.
Sure.
Like, thanks, guys. Well, I am fresh back from a vacation in Cuba, which was amazing. I went with a handful of friends, and we traveled a little bit throughout the northern part of the country, Havana to Viñales, and then I spent a little time on this island, Cayo La Visa, which I didn't find out until I got to the island. And this is kind of a little messed up that Cubans are not actually allowed to go to the island.
It's reserved for tourists?
Yeah. Apparently, the thinking is that because it puts you, you know, this like few nautical miles closer to the U.S., that there was a fear by the Cuban government that Cubans would come and use it as like a jumping off point.
Sure.
To come to the U.S., which doesn't even really make sense anymore because we no longer have the like wet foot, dry foot kind of policy. So there's like no reasons for Cubans to come on a boat to try to get to the U.S. because there's no longer asylum for them. But it was like this weird experience that I've never really had traveling where you're kind of in this space that is restricted to the people for whom the country you're visiting. I mean, I still enjoyed the beach. I'm not going to lie. I still had many pina coladas, but it was kind of a weird experience. But the thing I wanted to share from my trip, one of the things we got to do in Havana is connect with these amazing kind of radical feminist female rap group.
Really?
Yeah, called Lorena and Real. And they are two Cuban women who are part of the Cuban rap scene, which has this kind of really amazing history. Basically, the Castro regime was very anti-rap because the movement in the U.S. was often looked at as like highly politicized. Sure. And like bringing up topics that the Cuban government was kind of like, we'd rather you not. So I think the movement has remained somewhat kind of underground. And the although things are kind of changing as much in Cuba, I learned, is changing right now. And so it was kind of neat. We actually went to one of their homes and they like performed like a little mini concert for us, which was like totally thrilling. And they have this song that's all about like expectations in kind of domestic relationships and how, you know, men, especially Cuban men, you know, have this expectation that the women will cook for them.
Right.
And so, exactly. And so the kind of chorus line for this song is like basically translates to something like, you know, if you want rice, cook it yourself and let the rice burn. And so the chant when like is like, let the rice burn, let the rice burn. I don't know. It was just like really interesting to learn a little bit more about that space. The music is really fun. And they're actually going to be coming to the States in May to perform down in D.C. So I will pass that information forward as the kind of official date gets announced. But
that sounds awesome. By coincidence, I am actually going to a political musical performance this evening.
Nice.
Which is actually a Nationswide Council.
Yes,
event.
I'll be there.
Oh,
I'm
going to
see you at both ends of the day.
Yeah.
So give me the lowdown. Like, what are we in for?
This is going to be a truly unique event. We've never done anything like this before. This musical has never been performed in the Western Hemisphere before. So it's fascinating because one of our Nationswide Council members is a nationally recognized civil rights attorney, a guy named Ilan Mazel, and was involved in a class action suit a few years back involving the NSA and their domestic spying program, right? Obviously, hugely controversial but important topic. What's fascinating and unique about Ilan is that he's from an extremely musical family. So his father, Lauren, is internationally famous as having been a conductor of most of the world's great symphonies, including the New York Philharmonic, and a great composer in his own right. So classical musical folks will know who he is. So Ilan, despite being a lawyer by day, has always kept up. He's a world-class concert pianist, and
casually,
yeah, just casually
just
on
like
the side.
Other thing I do,
right? Yeah. That's how I roll too. Of course,
exactly.
So he was thinking a lot about this case, and inspired by a lot of the sort of dystopian fiction that he loves, things like 1984. And so he actually wrote this musical that's set in a dystopian near future in which there is essentially an all-powerful spy agency that can, you know, see, hear, record everything. And that is the premise for the musical. There are then a number of characters, interrogations, etc. So it was performed as part of a festival in Germany last year, received great reviews. And so this will be a stage reading of the first half of the musical here in New York. And the other thing that's going to be really fun, so Nationswide Council will get into it, but as you know, we're really more focused on the issues and meaningful substantive discussion. So we're also going to be pairing it with a panel right after the performance, and it's going to feature Edward Snowden's actual lawyer, who is also part of the ACLU, and then a prominent civil rights scholar from NYU's Brennan Center. And then we really value a diversity of opinion and perspective. We don't want it just to be like, domestic spying is bad and indefensible.
So you're like, who can talk, who can like represent the pro-domestic spying bias? And that's, who is it?
It's the last acting general counsel of the CIA.
Whoa. Okay, so.
So he's actually going to be, we can't think of really anyone better to try and defend the program.
Right.
Unless it was someone for the NSA, but. Pretty dang close. So yeah, he was acting general counsel of the CIA for, I believe, 6 years. So we're really excited to hear a meaningful, substantive, and ideologically diverse discussion going on.
Oh man, so I'm like pretty stoked about this day. I'm feeling like, one, I get to start with you in radio, and with this amazing reading of this musical, and then I'm also. I have my tickets for the David Bowie exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum this afternoon, which is supposed to be wild. So I'm feeling very cultured. I'm having a very New York day. But all right, so let's talk about Nation Swell Council, which of which you're the senior vice president. Give us the kind of like basic overview for folks who are not familiar.
Sure. So we're about 5 years old, and we're founded by our CEO, Greg Berman. He himself has a really interesting and diverse background, started in finance, felt like he wasn't making the world better, wanted to be part of the solution, so went and studied international relations at Oxford, wrote 2 books, one on the AIDS crisis in Africa and one on the Marshall Plan, and then wanted to be a doer rather than just a thinker. So served in the State Department and then actually in Afghanistan, active duty in the military. Redeployed and was really focused on looking for something that was bringing together people around the country who are doing great work. Seeing a big challenge, innovating a new way to address it, and finding innovative solutions that move the needle.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the thing that was identifying those people, elevating their voice, and bringing them together? And he kept looking for it and looking for it and looking for it and found that it didn't really exist, so he decided to create it. And so that's where Nation Swell comes from. Nation Swell like a groundswell. So there are 3 components to Nation Swell. Of which the council is one. So the first is independent journalism. We do mini documentaries and stories about innovative solutions. So one that was, I was just rereading, that is food focused, mm-hmm. that I think is really, really cool. So we profiled an organization in Atlanta called Concrete Jungle that focuses on solving 2 problems at once. One is food insecurity and malnutrition in inner city Atlanta. So there are big swaths of Atlanta that are high poverty and often lack access, reliable, cheap access at least, to fresh produce, healthy food, etc.
Sure, yeah.
The other problem is one of waste. So Atlanta is an extremely fertile part of the country. It's very green, warm, wet. And so there are literally thousands of fruit trees growing wild on public land across Atlanta. And typically the fruit just rots and falls to the ground. So Concrete Jungle literally uses, they've started experimenting with advanced Internet of Things sensors to detect when these trees are ripening. But they also use social media and digital tools to crowdsource volunteers when the fruit is ripe to go pick the fruit, wash it, and donate it to food banks specifically in those food deserts in Atlanta. So they are reducing waste and at the same time attacking food insecurity and malnutrition.
Sounds great. So you guys did, Nation Swell did like a little profile.
Exactly. Awesome. So that's an example of the kind of journalism we do. Focused on solutions. Yes, there are 1 million problems out there right now, but we focus on the people who are doing innovative work to
and
solve
like,
them.
Thank you for that, because I was just saying to someone the other day, I'm like, I want to start a business, or not a business, but like a listserv where I just send out like once a week or once a month, I'm like a good news digest.
Yes.
You know, I feel like people are so... on some level, unwilling to kind of step out of the news cycle,
right.
But at the same time, very tortured by it. I'm like, how can we create like just like a good news stream where you can go, you can recharge, you can kind of see like solution-oriented stuff? So I guess I'm like Like, just go to the Nation's Well site.
Yes.
I love that. You know that. Are you from? I love that. I've been thinking a lot lately about the rule of 10 feet, where basically, like, kind of everything you need is within 10 feet of you. It's kind of like a metaphorical 10 feet, but that often we're so busy looking like way beyond for a solution that we don't see the solutions or resources that are like right in our existing orbit. So more and more lately, I'm like, Aaron, just like look close, think about the people you know. And I'm like, I feel like it's constantly, I'm like, oh yeah, I already have that resource. So thank you for saving me the work.
Absolutely. Well, and that's actually part of what we do on the council side of things. So to finish answering your question, so that's our journalism. Platform two is our studio, which is essentially how we generate most of our revenue. We work with foundations, corporate social responsibility, mission-aligned brands to tell stories on their behalf. So you can hire us to make a little branded mini documentary, for example. But that's flagged as sponsored content the same way you'd see it on the New York Times or the Atlantic. And then the third component is what I lead, which is the Nation's Well Council. And so that's now over 800 of these socially minded, service-oriented, innovative leaders around the country. So I have a whole bunch of cool food-related examples I can give. But in general, we just look for folks who are doing innovative work, who are highly accomplished, who are demonstrably committed to a focus on solutions and to making their country a better place. We intentionally recruit across party lines because we think that there's not enough of that in this world right now. But you have to be someone who is productively political if you are political, willing to work across the aisle.
Yeah. Well, I would say as a fifth generation Texan, I would be curious to learn a little bit more about like your background on that end of things, kind of coming from Texas to New York, and you've lived a bunch of other places in between. I'm sure you've had like exposure to a variety of kind of assumptions about just kind of the way things are, the way people are.
Yes, and that has actually dramatically shaped my own views of the world. So I grew up in Houston, and I think my first awareness of the Texas identity beyond the state was watching The Simpsons.
Okay.
When I noticed that the only character that sounded like some of the folks that I knew was Cletus the Slack-Jawed Yokel.
Not a flattering characterization.
The guy who eats roadkill for dinner.
Didn't recognize yourself in him?
Well, no, what I recognized was that that is what is signaled sometimes by the rural Texas accent in particular. And so I remember being, I think I was 11 or 12, I spent a summer learning to modulate my vowels and sort of tamp down my accent because I was embarrassed.
How old were you?
11 or 12.
Wow. So, I mean, what does that look like? It's like little Taylor Chapman sitting in his bedroom.
I think it was more when I was like in the batting cage at batting practice. Uh-huh. I hated batting practice. And so I was always really bored, or sitting in the outfield. You may have be picking up on this, but I was terrible at baseball.
Okay.
They made me the catcher in T-ball, which in T-ball, you know, there's no pitch catch. So you can tell what a valuable asset I was on every team I played on. That's the sort of thing I would have been doing while sitting in the outfield.
Well, at least Texas isn't like really a big sports culture place.
Oh, you know? Exactly. Not, you know, that's not viewed askance by any Texans. What's going on with this sissy out here? I grew up in Houston, and then I came to Connecticut for college, and immediately everybody said, oh, you know, do you own a horse? Where's your cowboy hat? I do actually still own a cowboy hat.
Nice.
And I am wearing my cowboy boots today. So
representing.
I enjoy playing with the stereotypes a little bit.
Yeah.
But I also enjoy puncturing them. You know, I like telling people, for example, that Houston's the first major American city to elect an openly gay mayor, right?
Most people don't know that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She served her full term, reelected until she was term limited out. And it really wasn't a big issue in the elections either. She was the comptroller. She was known as like one of our wonkiest mayors, just a good steward of the budget and the public interest. It was super boring, and everybody focused on her competence more than her identity, which I find refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, I would love that.
Exactly, right?
You're like, guess what I would love to not talk about?
Exactly. So, but yeah, so I got, you know, I got to yell and people were like, oh, it's the Texan, you know, and there was a Texas club because we all felt a little bit side-eyed.
Yeah, well, you're with all them Yankees, right? I mean, it doesn't get really more East Coast than, like, you know, Yale, New Haven, Connecticut. Like, I have to say, I grew up in the Midwest. I'm from Michigan. So I find the kind of East Coastiness of East Coast, like, really fascinating. And it's, like, fun to, I think, in a similar way to you're saying, like, play Texan. Sometimes I feel like I play up the Midwest. And, sure. Like, but yeah, there must have been some culture shock going on for you.
A little bit, though. My mom wasn't from Texas, and I'd gotten out a bit already. I also, I mean, as you probably noticed, I'm a reflective person. So I had mentally prepared myself a little bit. But yeah, so it's, you know, I got up there, and everybody thought, oh, you must be, you know, a conservative or redneck Texan. And then I would go home on spring break and everybody's like, you must be a crazy East Coast liberal.
Yep.
And it was an extremely frustrating experience because also both sides made a ton of unfair assumptions about the other.
Yep.
Right. So, you know, I know a lot of folks here in New York who think that most Texans, especially those that vote Republican, are, you know, insane gun nuts and racists and ignorant. And I can tell you that I know many, many, many well-educated Texans who vote Republican who don't fall into that category. They do exist, but it's, you're doing yourself a huge disservice when you make those assumptions. And similarly, folks down there, you know, assume it's a bunch of elitist radicals who want, you know, socialism and those people exist too, of course.
But, yeah.
It's, you know, there's a lot more nuance. And I think the best experience I ever had in that regard is I worked construction one summer in Houston. And the two foremen that I worked with most closely were both born-again Christians. Actually, one white, one black. And so we're coming at politics, theoretically, from some different life circumstances, given that they had each been born in the 40s and 50s when Jim Crow was still very much a thing. But we used to have these long, wide-ranging political discussions over lunch, and we varied vastly on some of our opinions, but it always stayed completely civil and respectful. And each side actually scored some legitimate points off the other. And that really shaped the way I've looked at the world ever since.
I think, you know, it's like something I think about a lot lately is how do we work and how do I work at, like, building a culture of dialogue? Because I can really relate kind of going back and forth between those spaces similarly. Like, oh, it's that liberal school you go to, that big city you live in. And to a certain extent, when I'm back in Michigan, I feel like there's a cohort of people from my hometown who, you know, are, like, looking to push my buttons. And I feel like as I've gotten older and more skilled at, like, navigating those conversations, you know, we're both, like, learning more. But, okay, so you went from Texas up to Connecticut. And then was it right after college you decided to pursue Teach for America?
That's right. I started volunteering at a New Haven elementary school, and it really opened my eyes. I'd had incredible teachers, learning environments growing up, and I naively assumed that that was true for every child across America. Definitely not, especially once I got into the classroom myself in that volunteer capacity. So it really made me mad because I think one thing that actually any Texan, regardless of political stripe, can agree on is the principle of equality of opportunity, that if you're willing to get tough and scrappy and work hard, you ought to be able to at least have a shot at the American dream. That's the frontier bootstraps mythos, right? That's the whole point. And, you know, I saw that betrayed. So I joined the Teach for America program, taught high school Spanish in Charlotte, North Carolina. Really, definitely the hardest 2 years of my life. I was 22 and I had students who were 19.
Wow.
And had been in gang shootings and had just, like, were, for all practical purposes, older than I was, right? They'd seen a lot more of life. And so it was a really challenging way to be thrown into the deep end. But it taught me a ton. And I had a delightful Tuesday afternoon this week because I caught up with a student that I had not seen since Charlotte over 10 years ago. And he actually just moved to Bushwick, Brooklyn. He is a photographer and graphic designer and documentarian. And he's doing amazing work. And it was so cool to catch up with him. So I did that 2 years and then spent another 2 years as a public school teacher in Kumamoto, Japan, which is a semi-rural province in the south of Japan.
Okay.
Very different experience.
Yeah. So how do you go from Charlotte to Japan? You were like, you decided you wanted to keep teaching or you wanted a travel experience or like what was the impetus?
I also really love the novels of Haruki Murakami.
Okay.
But I had these teaching skills. I wanted to see more of the world and to learn a non-Western language. I've always been passionate about language. And so there's a great program called the JET program where the Japanese government recruits native English speakers in America, UK, Australia, and brings them over to be instructors in their public schools. Huh. So they kind of take care of all the logistics, which is great. And spent 2 years there, learned Japanese, learned a whole different set of assumptions about what school can mean. For example, Japanese schools don't have janitors.
Okay.
Because every day, all the students in the whole school split into teams of four right after lunch and clean the entire school top to bottom, scrubbing the floors, the windows, picking up all the trash, doing everything. And it only takes 20 minutes.
Right.
So it's not a waste of resources, really. But it really changes the tenor of the students' relationship to their school. I found that they took a lot more ownership and pride in the school, and it felt a bit more of a community than what I had often seen in the United States. So there's just a lot of things we take for granted or assume here in the United States that don't necessarily have to be so. And so that really taught me to consider things from first principles and to look beyond one's assumptions.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like, obviously, you're going to treat a space differently when you're responsible for it. Also, I just feel like the like application of like real, in a weird way, like knowing how to clean a toilet is a legit life skill that, like, you know, speaking from past roommate experience, not everyone has, but like should.
Yep.
Okay, so then after Japan, you know, the world is your oyster. You've conquered now, you know, two continents teaching. What was what brought you back to the U.S.?
In part, it was the 2008 elections. I had grown up very skeptical of politics in general. In Texas, that's pretty common. Regardless of where you fall on the ideological spectrum, there's a lot of, it's a bunch of corrupt old white men arguing, which is still sometimes true. But what I saw in the 2008 election was a lot of my friends back in the States getting super involved in the campaign, regardless of which side they're on, but feeling a ton of ownership and investment and like they had a voice in a way that I absolutely did not see in Japan. Everybody in Japan was very puzzled by how active the young Americans seemed to be. And Japan's a democracy. So it made me realize that, okay, our system has a lot of flaws, but it's actually better than a lot of what is out there. So that and my continuing passion for bridging the opportunity gap, which is what brought me to Teach for America, led me to the Kennedy School of Government, did a master's in public policy there, looking to figure out ways to scale my impact beyond a single classroom full of students. Like, what are the levers that can be helping improve outcomes for thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of students? So that's what took me there.
I feel like education is such, you know, as like a kind of policy area, an area to work in, it's kind of all the things. It reminds me a lot of food, actually, in that everyone has an experience with it. So you all, you know, you can feel like a certain sense of like ownership or even like personal expertise, right? Everyone went to school for at least some part of their life, right? And they had whatever experience they had. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's also a space where kind of innovation has come and kind of like fits and starts, and you're dependent in many ways on these like large institutions like the federal government that feel very other, feel very, in some ways, like beyond your control. And then there's all these economic access issues with regards to the kind of quality and the type of education that different people have access to. And similarly with food, you know, it's like the quality and type of food that you get to eat versus like what's kind of allotted to you or available in your neighborhood. It just feels like such a complicated place to be doing work in. And like, I wonder, kind of coming through like from your, you know, boots on the ground experiences in Charlotte and then in Japan and then going through kind of more of a policy perspective in graduate school, then you're like looking to go out in the world and like make your mark as you're surveying kind of employment options. What felt like salient to you? Where did you think like, and also kind of what didn't, you mm-hmm. know, because I'd have to imagine with that type of pedigree that you had, you know, the opportunity to be a bit choosy about your next role.
Yeah. And it is really hard. It's something that I find hardest in life is I am really interested in so many things. The world is a diverse, multifarious, and fascinating place. So how do you focus, prioritize, and choose? In this case, I looked at my classmates whose skill sets I really admired. So mm-hmm. I was, you know, it was a class of 220 and everybody was remarkable. I loved getting to know everyone. And then, but there were some folks in a lot of my classes who every time there was a project, a presentation, an analysis, they just crushed it and they did it faster than everyone else. And I started to notice a pattern, you know, where did they get these skills? A lot of them had spent some time at one of the big consulting firms. Mm-hmm. So like a McKinsey, Bain, BCG. Not that it wasn't something necessarily about that being an essential must-have on your resume so much as they had gotten something very right about training and imparting a very particular set of skills around communication, analysis, efficiency, prioritization. So I just thought, okay, all these people acquired an amazing skill set there.
Right.
Maybe that's worth doing. And I was the two options that were top of mind were that and the U.S. State Department, the Foreign Service Office.
Okay.
So
pretty different.
Fairly, yes and no, actually. Okay. Because they're both generalist roles.
Okay.
Right? So I spent a summer working at State Department between my 2 years at Kennedy. And I loved it. I was on the Japan desk, so I knew a lot of the context. But what was really cool is every day was different. So one day I might be ghostwriting a letter to the Japanese Prime Minister from the Secretary of State about X, Y, or Z. The next day I was doing an analysis on illegal whaling and, you know, what were the trends over time and how could we lobby the Japanese government to reduce its quote-unquote scientific harvesting of whales.
Wow.
So, you know, it just super varied work, which really appealed to me yeah. as a generalist. And McKinsey was the same way because there were times where I spent a week, literally a 2 week long project, just learning the ins and outs of the coloring book market and how they are sold and distributed across the U.S., followed by the polyurethane foam industry, which was, let me tell you about polyurethane foam.
Oh, man, look at the time. Look at the time.
No, but the variety was really, really fascinating. So there's actually more in common than you might think.
Okay.
I went there just to get that skill set. And I actually asked my old mentor from the State Department, because I was considering between the two, and he said, go do McKinsey. You'll make a better public servant down the line.
Down the line.
Because of the skills you get there.
That makes sense. Well, all right. I really do need to watch the time, actually, because we should take a short break to hear a little bit more from our amazing sponsor, Whole Foods. Thanks for keeping us on the air. Let's hear a quick word from them, and then we'll be back. You're listening to Recommended Reading. I am your guest host, Aaron Fairbanks, and we are in studio with Taylor Chapman. Hang tight. We're going to be right back.
Don't go in for understanding when you are away. Can't use my heart to think away the time. In my room I will await you, and so soon I will relate you. And tie your finger right on up to mine. Sweet Josephine.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group, or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
Ooh, yeehaw! I think that's a little something from, you know, your homeland, maybe. Some bringing some twang back for our Texan in studio. Well, we are back, and I want to transition a little bit more because while we have you, Taylor, I have to imagine that you are a font of excellent recommendations across the board. And just kind of jumping off your experience in Japan, I mean, I feel like in the food world in particular, but I think beyond that, there has been this kind of obsession with Japan and Japanese culture. That's really been growing in the last couple of years. So for folks who are maybe thinking about a trip or thinking about having some type of cultural experience here in the States, like what's at the top of your list?
Yes, at the very top would be En Naka. So this is a restaurant in Los Angeles. If any of y'all have watched Chef's Table on Netflix, they're featured, I think it's episode 3 of the whole series. The chef and sous chef are married, Carol and Nikki Nakayama.
Uh-huh.
And their story is fascinating. You know, family, children of immigrants in LA, very passionate about the sort of cultural melting pot that is LA. And they talk a lot about how that's influenced their food and their philosophy. It's kaiseki, so it's a really, it's a great Japanese food discipline that focuses on what's in season and what's local. So every night the menu is different. It's typically 10 courses, really involved. It's actually kind of hard to get a table there because they do small seatings, but they're fascinating folks. So they are members of our Nation's Well Council.
Okay.
And so last week we actually hosted an event there for about 20 of our Los Angeles members.
Oh, nice.
It was really cool. and on the same topic, one of the other attendees was the CEO of a company called This Bar Saves Lives, which is also a food company. So I don't know if you've run across them, but it's... you know, shorthand would be sort of Tom's or Warby Parker, but for food bars. They, okay. With every granola bar purchased, they donate
one
meal.
Oh, I was thinking like cocktail bar, but yeah okay. Yeah, granola bar. I got it. I'm with you.
I think they're sold at Whole Foods. little plug there. But yeah, so it's cool. For every bar purchased, they donate one meal's worth of life-saving food aid somewhere in, you know, the developing world or in food crisis. And it was started by a number of actors out in LA who had made a humanitarian trip and wanted to, instead of giving a one-time donation, create an enterprise that would use sort of the engine of capitalism in order to create conditions for ongoing donations and support for this food. So it's a really cool project. It was actually co-founded by Kristen Bell, the person from Frozen and all of those movies.
All right.
So it's a cool company.
Nice.
Would recommend them. The other is a cool nonprofit that we profiled recently called Katie's Crops. It was started by, she was very young, maybe 11 or 12 at the time, a girl named Katie, who grew a cabbage for a school project, and it became huge. It was like a 60-pound cabbage, and donated it to a food bank, and was shocked to see that, you know, when made into a ham and cabbage soup, it was able to feed, you know, literally 100-plus people.
Right.
And it got her very passionate about the fact, like, why don't more kids grow food and donate it to food banks? And they've now... it's now gone viral. We made a video about them that's, you know, racked up millions of views. And there are now Katie's Crops gardens at schools in hundreds of cities and towns across America, donating thousands of pounds of fresh produce.
All starting with the humble cabbage.
Yeah.
I am such a cabbage, like, a fiend. I'm like, one, it's like appeals to my Midwest sensibilities, but two, it's like this like kind of remarkable vegetable, super high in vitamin C, really inexpensive. It has all these different preparations. I feel like a cabbage evangelist. So thanks. I mean, that speaks to me. one of the things we learned about when I was in Cuba that I thought was super fascinating, is this thing called the package. or the packet. And in Cuba, internet access is really unreliable, if available at all, and incredibly slow. And so the Cuban people, I think, are in many ways kind of like used to dealing in like a scarcity economy. And so they're kind of, they have this fascinating like internet hack, which is basically once a month, there are these kind of packet dealers around the country who have pulled about a terabyte's worth of internet material onto an external hard drive. And you can go and for like one kook, which is roughly a dollar or two kook, you can go with your MP3 drive or your external hard drive and kind of download as much as you can of the packet. And so it's all kinds of like American television or worldwide music or all kinds of stuff. But then you can also, if you're a Cuban artist, pay to have your work
featured
in the thing. And you can feature it in a bunch of different ways. One, it can just like be in there under your name, under your file. So you can tell your listeners or supporters to go check it out there. Or for like a higher fee, they'll like splice your music video into the middle of like a Game of Thrones episode.
Oh, no way.
Or something that like, yeah. So it was like really kind of this like, it's like a little bit hard to wrap your head around. And then also two of the women I was traveling with work in marketing and they were like, you could see their eyes kind of like lighting up with the potential here. But I wanted in the last couple of moments we have here to do kind of a little bit of a rapid fire of like what you might put in the kind of Taylor Chapman packet. So first thing that comes to mind, and like this isn't like favorite all time. This is just like a thing you're kind of into right now. So what would be the soundtrack of your packet?
Most recently, I've been listening a ton to, I think it's the first or second album by The War on Drugs, which is a great indie rock band that I actually saw play here in Greenpoint a couple years ago. I'm a big fan of Wilco's early work, but you also can never beat the Beatles.
Yeah, all right. So some classics, some new stuff, some classics. I like it. Recommended reading?
Steven Pinker, The Better Angels of Our Nature. Amazing book on the fact that human violence has actually radically declined over the course of our history, including through the 20th century and today. So as Bill Gates likes to say, the headlines are bad, but the trend lines are good. And he marshals an incredibly impressive array of evidence to show that that is the case. There's a quick plug there. If you're Brooklyn people, go check out the Secret Science Club in Gowanus. Once a month, they bring in an eminent scientist to give a free talk intelligible to the layman. So Steven Pinker is a Harvard professor, really impressive guy, many books published, and just came there, spoke for free in the back of a bar in Brooklyn. It was wonderful.
You're just like randomly having a drink and you're like, oh, this super famous guy that I would like never have heard of. All right. Your packet social media feed that you couldn't live without?
Definitely Instagram. I do some photography on the side for fun. And so that's certainly what I'm most addicted to.
Awesome. Your go-to kind of packet food rec?
Burritos. I'm a Texan.
Okay. Your don't mess with Texan piece of like cultural memorabilia.
Oh, definitely my rattlesnake skin cummerbund. I went to the world's largest rattlesnake roundup the last 3 years running.
What?
Yeah, they have. There were over 10,000 live snakes rounded up last year on local ranches.
Real snakes?
Oh, yeah, live snakes. It's a crazy thing. I'll send you photos if you like. But they also, they kill and skin all the snakes, and they're all made into various goods, and the meat is eaten. They always have Miss Texas there, and she engages in the rattlesnake eating contest.
Wow.
Very strange. But they'll also let you skin a snake yourself and keep the skin. So I skinned a snake and had it made into a rattlesnake skin cummerbund, which I wore to a wedding recently.
Now you're like looking for excuses to wear a cummerbund. You're like, is it formal? Because I have something.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, Taylor, thank you so much. It was great to have you on and learn a little bit more about you and Texas and education and, of course, the Nation's Well Council.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if folks want to follow you, they can find you on Instagram or Twitter. It's Yote Kiro. Can you tell me? So it's Y-O-T-A-Y, which is kind of a play on your name. And then Kiro, Q-U-I-E-R-O. Where does the name come from?
It's just a pun in Spanish. Yo te quiero is how you say I love you in Spanish. And I was just looking for, you know, an AIM handle, I think, in 1999 that hadn't been taken.
Old school.
Yeah. So I punned off my name and off a common Spanish phrase, and I've kept it ever since.
That's awesome. All right. Well, that is a wrap. I want to give a shout out to Kim and Amanda, who will be back in the studio next week. I had a great time co-hosting. Ladies, I'm available anytime. Thank you, of course, to Ryan Little, who does the theme song for the show, to David, our engineer out there in the booth, and of course to Whole Foods, our sponsor this week. This has been another episode of Recommended Reading with Food Book 4. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.